Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. Once upon a time, years and years ago, I went to my local bank and told them that I would like to borrow $2,137. That at the time was the exact cost of a brand new 750 Triumph motorcycle. They said, not the sort of thing we normally approve. And besides, you don't have a credit rating. Well, I said, what would you normally approve? Oh, they said, suppose you wanted to panel your rec room. Okay, so I borrowed $1,000 for 6 months, put it under a pillow, and carefully paid it back. The day that I was done with the final payment, I rushed back to the bank and said, now I want $2,137 so I can buy that motorcycle. Ah, they said, the trouble is you have no credit rating. What do you mean I don't have any credit rating? I just borrowed $1,000 from you and paid it back, every penny of it. Yes, they said, you did, but you see, you paid it all back. You don't owe us anything. You don't owe anybody anything. And that means you have no credit rating. Well, it wasn't such a big deal. Maybe I should be grateful to them for keeping me off of that death machine. But nah, I'm not grateful. I'm still ticked off about it. Down in my heart, I still believe that banks are weasels. There is some good evidence for this, as you're about to hear. Producer Gary Covino is taking us to Chicago today for a look at what is called redlining. That is, the reluctance of banks to make loans to certain people in certain neighborhoods. This is a lot more serious than motorcycles. This is about people's entire lives.
Early morning in the dead of winter at the Circle Urban Ministries in Austin. These people have braved the cold, the ice, and the searing wind to gather in this church meeting room. They live in one of the poorest parts of town, but today they've come to learn. To learn what it will take to buy a house.
One of the old saws in our business is the three C's of mortgage lending: collateral, credit, and character. The lender looks at all three of these things when evaluating a loan. Collateral.
The people in this room taking notes, black, working class, struggling to make ends meet, know it won't be easy, but the information gives them hope.
I'm truly excited. I look forward to having my own backyard. My own backyard, my basement. Then hopefully I can make a playroom in the attic, an entertainment room, three or four bedrooms. Someplace I can just, you know, I can live happily. My own home, my own home.
Chicago is, of course, famous for being a city of neighborhoods with strong ethnic identities and traditions. But it's also a city of lines, color lines that are strictly enforced and easy to see. All over this city, you can find the streets that serve as the borders. In one direction, a white area. In the other, blacks or other minority groups. Their territories fixed, their neighborhoods rigidly defined. Englewood on the south side is one such place. Solidly black for decades and now, in large part, devastated. Henry Llewellyn is a community activist who's lived in Englewood for more than 30 years.
The neighborhood have died. That's what happened. The sense of when a neighborhood dies, there when you can't get money to invest in a neighborhood, it dies like a human body.
Henry Llewellyn is convinced that Englewood didn't just die, but that it was killed by banks that won't make loans there. And he doesn't have to go far to find evidence. All he has to do is walk across the street from his own home.
The bank have redlined this area, and the bank won't lend money into the area for the people's tour, or rehab and take care of their property. So what people do, they walk out of the neighborhood and they leave the house abandoned. This has been vacant about a year. And this, when it came vacant, it was a perfect house. It was livable. See, all that was aluminum-sided. Ain't no windows in there. There's no furnace in there. They have tore everything out of this house. This house was perfect.
Redlining, the practice of systematically denying loans in certain neighborhoods, is illegal. But even though it's been outlawed, even though an impressive legal edifice has been built up over the years to stop it, redlining is still a fact of life in every major American city. Laws meant to protect consumers against lending discrimination have been on the books for a quarter century. The Fair Housing Act, passed in 1968, prohibits banks from denying loans in particular neighborhoods. Since then, Congress has strengthened anti-redlining laws. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act, passed in 1974, outlaws lending bias against individuals on the basis of race. That was followed by the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977. The CRA states that banks have an obligation to serve low and moderate income neighborhoods. But 16 years after it became law, Henry Llewellyn is still waiting for the CRA to come to Englewood.
Can't get a mortgage in this neighborhood to buy. There's nobody to lend money. And if you can't get money, you can't buy a house. We are not begging the banks to give us money. We just want the bank to lend us money, and we will pay it back.
Bank officials often say that it's too risky to loan money in poor neighborhoods, although several studies in recent years have shown that poor and working class people, overall, have better payback rates than wealthier clients. But let's examine the cases of two couples who are doing very well financially, who seem to have all the credentials necessary to get mortgages, and who are convinced that it was the color of their skin that kept them from getting loans. First, Maria Saldana and Donald Davidson. When they went looking for a home for themselves and their four children, they found the perfect one on the West Side, in Austin. Income levels in Austin are close to the average for Chicago, but mortgage investment there is 35% below the citywide average. On paper, Maria and Donald seem like excellent candidates for a loan. He's a real estate developer. She's a lawyer for the city. The year they went house hunting, her salary was $69,000. Her other outside income nearly doubled that. Their combined assets topped $1 million. But when Maria went to a branch of Citibank for a $190,000 mortgage and construction loan, she was turned down.
They rejected me. They sent me a rejection letter and turned me down. They said that I had a bad credit history.
Maria Saldana's credit report included two late mortgage payments a few years ago, some credit cards at their limit, and an unpaid $6 fee on an old student loan, a loan which had been paid off. The rest of her credit history was clean. When banks want to do business with potential clients, they usually work to clear up these types of small blemishes on credit records. But in this case, after many delays, the bank said no. Maria's first reaction after being rejected for the loan was shock. Then she says she felt embarrassed and ashamed.
It's like, gee, I guess I'm not good enough, you know. I went to Stanford in undergrad. I got a Berkeley Law degree. I have a job that pays $69,000. But somehow, I'm doing something wrong, and I feel like it's me. I mean, I'm just not good enough. I thought I was doing all the right things, but I'm not.
I'm saying that from day one, they didn't intend to make the loan.
Maria's husband, Donald, is convinced that Citibank officials went into the process with their minds already made up.
I think they didn't like one of two things, and I think it's both of them. I don't think they like Maria and myself being a Hispanic woman and a black male, and I don't think they liked making that investment in this neighborhood.
In a letter turning down a request to be interviewed for this report, Citibank officials repeated that Maria Saldana was denied a mortgage due to her credit performance on her own personal loans. But Donald Davidson doesn't buy it.
I'm on a bank board, an S&L board. I review single-family loans once a month. I review rejections and approvals. I know how the game is played, and I know how you can hide any reason, any way you don't want to make a loan. I'm a real estate developer by trade. I'm a mortgage banker by trade. My wife is a lawyer. You can kid a lot of people, but you can't kid us.
Our second couple is Peter and Dolores Green. It would seem that they shouldn't have trouble getting a mortgage either. They're a black professional couple. He's a state employee, and she works for a publishing company. Between them, they earn around $60,000 a year. The Greens wanted to buy the six-unit apartment building they've lived in for decades. It's in West Garfield Park, and it's been their only home since they were married.
We had spoken so many times over about owning that piece of property, and it's really nothing necessarily so beautiful or what have you, but it's still special, you know, in its own way.
The Greens neighborhood has definitely seen better times and never completely recovered from the 1968 riots. But now it could be on the way back. Next to the vacant lots and boarded-up buildings are rehabs and new townhouses. Their friends always tried to talk them into leaving. But Peter Green says that even in the worst times, he and Dolores never wanted to move.
That's the one thing that we could have done at any point in time. But to run is very easy. And I see too much of that. We're not quitters. We're not runners. And I think really that's it. We just didn't feel that we had to run, that we in fact could make it as good as it once was, if not in fact better.
And so Peter Green went looking for a mortgage. He thought it would be a simple process, given his and Dolores' background, income, and professional status.
I really didn't expect a problem, very frankly, given the fact that my assets far exceeded that which I was seeking to borrow. What can I say? I fully expected to be treated fairly and receive a mortgage.
But he had a hard time getting anyone to even take his application. He tried 8 different banks. At some, he was told they weren't making any housing loans. At others, they said they weren't loaning in his area. At a couple, he couldn't even get an appointment to speak to the loan officer. Studies of redlining practices have shown this to be a typical pattern. Black applicants are often misled or given no help from loan officers, while white applicants are treated very differently. Finally, on the advice of a friend, Peter Green tried the Avenue Bank of Oak Park. The loan officer he spoke with there was John Hill.
I look positively on everything. And I could see us making this loan. So I went ahead and took his application, talked to him about doing it, and wanted to do it.
But Hill's supervisor didn't want to make the loan and told him to take the application to the bank's president.
So I did. I went and I talked to the president, showed him the thing, and this took all of about 2 minutes.
When the Greens learned that their loan had been denied, they were devastated.
You start asking yourself, what did I do wrong? Is there something wrong with me that I'm not aware of?
That's the hurt.
Yeah, that's the hurt.
It's a killer.
And it's something that you can do absolutely nothing about.
Because, you know, we've done everything that society has asked of us. Mm-hmm. Gone to school, learned to read and write. We've not been a burden on society or the welfare rolls. We pay our taxes. We pay our bills on time. We're good citizens. And then when you find, God, were you a dummy to have worked that hard, to have done all of this, and you're going to still be treated in this manner? That's serious, and that hurts.
I'd like to call the next panel of witnesses. We'll ask the witnesses to proceed in the order that they were called, and we look forward to their testimony.
Once a year, Congress returns to the issues of race, credit, and redlining when it holds hearings on compliance with the Community Reinvestment Act.
First, let me start by saying that what we feel is going on here is a failure of the overall system as it works for the home mortgage industry in this country. There are many laws already on the books to see that these problems don't come about, but we seem to come back here year after year, basically report the same numbers, and we'll come back again next year and do the same thing again. But the problem of mortgage discrimination, lender discrimination still exists and is very pervasive across this country.
There are 4 federal agencies that regulate financial institutions. They're charged with enforcing the laws against lending discrimination. One of them is the Federal Reserve. In late 1991, the Fed released the first comprehensive national study of loan discrimination.
The new data show that loan approval rates differ among different ethnic, racial, and income groups.
The information was gathered under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act of 1975, which is known as HMDA. The findings were dramatic. The study showed that while whites of all income levels were turned down for mortgages 14% of the time, blacks were rejected at a 34% rate, more than twice as often. And one statistic was especially telling. The study found that higher-income blacks were rejected 21% of the time, while lower-income whites were rejected only 14% of the time. In other words, it's easier to get a mortgage if you're a poor white than if you're a well-to-do black. John LaWare is a governor of the Federal Reserve Board.
These most recent HMDA data are like a lot of smoke. You got to believe there's some sort of fire down there creating the smoke, but it's hard at this stage of the game to tell just what that is.
This is what usually happens when new studies, and there have been plenty of them, with more being done all the time, show statistical evidence of widespread redlining. Officials charged with doing something about it usually say what John LaWare said. Something seems to be happening here, but we're not sure exactly what it is. After the Fed released the HMDA numbers, the banking industry said that more study was needed to determine whether those figures really show deliberate racism in lending decisions.
Of course, this data proves that there's discrimination. You have to be absolutely blind not to see that.
Former Senator William Proxmire sponsored the Community Reinvestment Act back in 1977. He says that regulators ignored the reality reflected by the Federal Reserve study.
Well, I make plenty of those numbers because what it showed was people with the same income, the rejection rate on blacks was more than twice as high. Furthermore, the really bombshell here was the fact that the blacks who had the highest income were turned down more often than whites who had the lowest income. In other words, a black person, even though they made more money, even though they had a good credit rating and so forth, was turned down because they were black. Clear, clear discrimination of the grossest kind. Just enraging.
Proxmire is upset with regulators for not using the legal tools that Congress has given them. He thinks it's because the regulatory agencies have become too cozy with the industry they're supposed to oversee.
Regulators are doing a lousy job from any standpoint. A lousy job. Very poor. They will take a position every time, defensive of the people they're regulating, and that is wrong. You can't have any kind of a system that works when you have that kind of regulation.
Housing activists, academics, and consumer advocates have been pressuring the Federal Reserve to use testers to determine just how much discrimination there is in mortgage lending, and more importantly, just how it takes place. Testers are paired couples. Actors, really, who go into banks to apply for loans and then report back on how far they get and how they're treated. Each couple is set up with a financial history that's basically the same as far as income, assets, and credit records. But one couple will be white, while the other will be black or minority. In studies where testing has been used, the white couples are often given courteous and helpful treatment, while black couples are often discouraged from applying or given misleading information. This type of testing isn't new. It's routinely used by some other government agencies charged with civil rights enforcement, and it's often tried by community groups. The Federal Reserve has the legal authority to use testing in banks today to help enforce the Community Reinvestment Act, but so far has refused to do so. Another agency that oversees banks is the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. There, too, the debate over testing has a long history. In 1978, Zena Green was brought in to head up the OCC's Fair Lending Enforcement Office. She immediately began to press for vigorous action to fight redlining, including the use of testers.
There was no interest in getting at the truth of this. I was told without any exception, and that there would never be any exception, that the Comptroller's Office would never test. Nor should I ever mention testing.
After a year, Zena Green left the OCC.
I knew this was an organization that did not want to find discrimination. It was clear. It was eminently clear. I came there as a director of division. Within a few months, it was rearranged, and I was just off there by myself with a secretary.
In 1991, after those dramatic HMDA numbers were released, members of Congress tried to force some action against redlining by bringing a mandatory testing bill to the House floor. One co-sponsor was Representative Joe Kennedy of Massachusetts.
The problem is not bad laws, it's bad enforcement. Bank regulators are asleep at the switch.
They treat banks like golfing partners, not banks.
But the bill quickly ran into trouble.
It may be the ultimate intrusion in the American system.
Will the gentleman
yield? The problem is real. It's a secret police solution modeled more after the KGB than it is any part of the American model.
In the end, the testing measure lost by 89 votes.
The people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated.
There is one provision of the Community Reinvestment Act that has given housing activists a potent weapon. It allows local groups to challenge bank mergers, which can't go forward without federal approval. It's a way to expose and correct discrimination in lending.
If anybody wants to know what this red mark, what this red ribbon going around the lobby is all about, we are redlining the Federal Reserve Bank because they're allowing affiliated banks to redline our neighborhood.
All right! Yeah. 2, 4, 6, 8. We want loans, we want rates. 2, 4, 6, 8. We want loans, we want rates.
Here, early last year, at the Federal Reserve Building in the Loop, members of the housing advocacy group, ACORN, gathered to fight the proposed merger of Affiliated Bank of Chicago with another bank, Comerica. They gave Federal Reserve officials surveys, statistics, and maps which they said proved that Affiliated didn't loan to minorities and wouldn't put branches in black communities. The ability to stop a multi-million-dollar merger gave ACORN leverage.
Hello, Sandra Maxwell.
Hi, I'm Hi. Hi. Yeah, Larry, yes, my pleasure. Hi.
Good. Come on in.
Yeah, good.
Welcome.
And so, on a wintry weekday night, this improbable scene. Officials of the two banks came to ACORN's drafty headquarters to try and work out an accommodation. They barely had their coats off before the ACORN members, poor people from the black parts of town, confronted them with their demands. One of the activists was Henry Llewellyn from Englewood.
Our problem is we need banking in the low and moderate income era where our community is 100% black. And everybody have redlined our community. We ain't here asking for welfare. We asking for service.
You have all your banks is out in the rich part of the city. Mm-hmm. You have nothing for us.
See, if you don't lend us money, then we got to move in your community, and then you got to start running. Because you don't want to stay where blacks there. So why don't you put a branch in Englewood so I don't have to give you trouble? Huh? You know, huh? You don't want the blacks out there. We trouble. Your property going to go down. You think? Your grass don't grow where black people walk. See what I'm saying?
The anger is very real, and it's something that's ingrained in what it is that they do. It is a sense of what we saw in the 60s, the social activism.
Brenda Schneider was at the meeting. She's director of community relations for one of the banks.
Should that anger be vented at financial institutions? I don't believe so. I believe that there is a greater issue of public policy that addresses all of the needs of our urban cities. And financial institutions in and of themselves have a niche in addressing reinvestment patterns in urban cities. But in and of themselves, they are not the single way of addressing or resolving all of the urban problems that are facing America.
What did you bring with you tonight that you can ensure us that you're going to deal with us in good faith?
I think the fact that we're here, the important thing is that we are here. We are listening. I'm taking diligent notes, as is Mr. Hammond. It is our intent to respond to you, to look at the concerns that you have and address those with the bank's executive management, and we will come back to you. We assure you of that.
Your bank have not been communicating with us. And I say us, ACORN, and the community. So it's up to you. It's not up to us now. It's up to you. You're going to have to deal with us now. That's it.
After 4 months of negotiations, demonstrations, and pressure, the bank and ACORN reached an agreement. Affiliated agreed to grant more mortgages in low-income areas of Chicago and gave ACORN a $25,000 grant to continue its anti-redlining work. The Federal Reserve then approved the bank's merger. A victory. But in a city the size of Chicago, with huge areas still underserved, investment poor, and dying, it's a small victory at best. And Chicago is just one city. No different when it comes to these problems than any large city in America. Donald Davidson and Maria Saldana were able to get a loan from another bank. They're busy rehabbing their new home, and they're filing suit against Citibank.
Because I think that what's going on is some kind of subtle discrimination. If it is, I want them to pay for it.
And there's another reason why. Because we don't want the same thing to happen to our kids. We're tired of it happening to us.
Peter and Dolores Green also finally got a mortgage, and they were able to buy their apartment building. The Greens also sued Avenue Bank.
Look, I'm not Dr. King. I don't want to be thought of as a Rosa Parks or anything like that. But it appears that there's been a serious problem in this area dealing with banks for some time. I'm but one person who was dumped upon, okay? And I don't like it. I'd like to think that there are persons out there who are going to develop enough courage to stand up and say, no, not here.
Last December, Avenue Bank's parent company settled the lawsuit. The Greens won $250,000 in damages and attorney's fees. The bank also promised three community groups that it will grant more loans to minority applicants. The Greens say they'll open an account at Avenue Bank with the settlement money. Dolores Green told one reporter that, after all, the only thing the couple had ever wanted to do was take their business there. Meanwhile, Henry Llewellyn keeps walking the streets of Englewood, convinced that his desolate neighborhood can still be transformed.
No, it's not too late. What I want to see happen in this neighborhood, that it can be money lent in this neighborhood where all of these houses can be rehabbed, then built back, and put back on the tax roll. They say it can't be did. I say it can be did. You get enough people believing like I am, we can do it. No matter what happens, I'm going to fight, I'm going to meet, I'm going to talk to people. Sooner or later, I will win.
Your Loan is Denied was produced by Gary Covino in association with the Center for Investigative Reporting and Frontline. It originally aired on Soundprint in 1992. Since then, Henry Llewellyn says that some banks, not all, have begun to lend money in his neighborhood. The suit against Citibank, brought by Maria Saldana and her husband, is still in litigation. Your Loan is Denied is part of The People Next Door, a special Soundprint series funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Additional support is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation. Write us with your ideas and comments. Write Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50. To order by credit card, call us at 202-885-1285. That's 202-885-1285. On the internet, our address is soundprint at american.edu. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria DeFreitas, Studio Engineer Robin Wise, Production Assistant Francesca Raymond. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett.